Hello and welcome to this episode of Nucleus Wealth in Power, where I, Shelley George, Head of Operations at Nucleus Wealth, go looking for what the good life is and how finance can support and empower us in achieving that. So I'd like to start today in the spirit of reconciliation by acknowledging the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to the land, sea and community. I pay my respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. So today I'm joined by my colleague Damien Klassen, Head of Investments at Nucleus Wealth, to help try and illuminate for some of those that find them a bit puzzling the Nucleus Wealth performance reports and more generally investment performance. Welcome, Damien.
Thanks, Shelley.
A quick reminder before we get started, if you haven't already, subscribe and click the notification bell to be notified when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. We also ask if you could take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. So turning to today's episode, what I wanted to try and do was give people who don't know much about investing and don't have a great deep understanding of what a professional investment manager does, an idea of how they go about constructing investment portfolios. I know over my time working in finance and sitting in investment management meetings, I sort of have thought of an investment portfolio as a sort of spiky sort of 3D object that you look at from different angles and you see how things happening in the world flow through and affect that portfolio from the different angles. So we're going to start by looking at that construction and then use the framework that we have for portfolio construction to talk about, in particular, Nucleus Wealth's March performance report. So next slide, please, Jaden. Thank you. So what I've listed here is a list, I don't think it's complete, but it is definitely extensive, of some of the things that you consider, some of these angles of this 3D object that is a portfolio you consider when you're looking at it. So I thought let's start at the very top with asset allocation. So not all investments will have an asset allocation that they'll talk about, but they will all have an asset allocation in that if it's an equity fund, it means it's got a zero allocation to bonds and cash and that sort of thing. So do you want to talk us through the assets?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the key things when, as we're trying to put together these portfolios is trying to look at what we call asymmetrical bets. So they're the bets where you take a bet on it, you can see some upside and you can see that the downside's not so, is not that dramatic. And so a lot of investment is really about trying to put together portfolios in that way. You know, we'd all love to be able to get every single call right every single time, but the reality is you can't. And also markets will move in different directions. They're not quite sure whether, one theme is going to be the dominant theme. And so you might see, you know, right now we'll see tech stocks outperform one day and underperform the next day, and sort of a bit of back and forth. And so you can't be expected to get every single time, but what you want to make sure is that if you do make mistakes, that those mistakes aren't going to cost you dearly in your portfolio. And we've seen a few sort of hedge funds blow up recently using there was a GameStop, so Melbourne Capital was one of those ones where they'd taken some really big what's called short positions in it, and when those went wrong, you know, that blew up large parts of their portfolio. Another one, Archegos, I think is the name.
Archegos? I think I might have heard Bloomberg say that.
So I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, but they basically took some big bets on stocks, but then they used debt to really leverage up their positions. Mm-hmm. And so when the stocks went the opposite way, they actually end up blowing up the entire fund. And so for us, putting together a portfolio is about avoiding those types of issues where you're so heavily weighted towards one theme that if it goes against you, the whole thing's going to come unstuck.
That's it, it's finished.
So you want to try and say, I can see where we think the future's going, we're going to take bets in that direction, but I need to make sure I've got enough other things within the portfolio that if it goes the wrong way, it's not quite going to cost the, it's not going to cost you everything.
Yeah. Okay. There's so much to unpack there, but I'm going to re-ask the question. Mm. Can you tell us what your definition of the different asset classes is
that
don't know?
Yeah, sure. So the key ones, the key big ones is equities. So, and that's where you're buying into a company and you're taking the most amount of risk, but you're going to get the most amount of return from it.
So that's ownership, right? You're actually buying tiny portion of ownership in a company. Yeah?
Exactly. Okay. Yes. And so a company will make their sales. They'll pay their employees and costs. Then they'll pay the debt holders. Then they'll pay the government in terms of taxes. And whatever's left, the whole amount goes to you as a shareholder. And it could be negative. So you know, shareholders have to put more money in. But if it's positive, and it's often quite positive to reward shareholders for taking the most amount of risk.
Okay.
And then you sort of start going back up the investment structure is you can get what's called corporate debt. And there's a whole bunch of different types of corporate debt. The two most common ones are seen as being the high yield corporate debt, which is the really risky stuff. Companies that may very well go broke. And then sort of in what's called investment grade corporate debt. And those investments will pay you a higher return in terms of your interest rate, but you don't have that significant upside. So basically, you might get an interest rate, say, at the moment of 4 or 5%, which is really good, much higher than what you can get in the bank and all those things. But you are taking a big risk, and you're not going to make any more than 4 or 5%. The risk is that if you're holding this thing to maturity, the risk is the company actually goes broke, and you end up with a negative return on it.
Okay. I actually want to talk about that the risk and the because that's an asymmetric return, but the opposite way almost that you want
exactly.
to take it. Before we get into that, can we just explain at a high level like debt, how that works? So if you invest in debt, tell me if this is right. If I invest in a debt product, what I am doing is lending money to that company. So for equity, I'm taking an ownership stake in the company,
yep.
and for debt, I'm lending them money.
Exactly.
Okay. And so when you talk about high yield versus investment grade, again, correct me if I'm wrong, so stepping back into debt and equity, it's really important to think about them in terms of like if the entity has to close down, it goes bankrupt, then these investments, they have a hierarchy within that, right?
Yes.
So, and that hierarchy refers to who gets returned the money first, the stakeholders who will get paid out first.
Yep.
And equity is generally right at the bottom, right?
Yep. They're the last one to get the money back.
And that's why, is that the only reason, or is it just one of the reasons why equity is typically the most riskiest one of the more risky forms of investment?
Yeah, that's the main one. There's not a legal obligation to actually have to pay dividends. There's not a legal obligation to have to get the money back.
Okay.
So,
whereas when you loan company money as an investment, there's a contract there that says we have to make these interest payments back to you. So that's a legal agreement that you're talking about.
Yeah, and the issue with the debt is... as you spoke, you can have lots of different levels of debt, junior debt and senior debt. And so basically what can happen is you can have debt where the company owes you the money, but then depending upon how it's been structured, you might find later on that they've actually gone and borrowed some more money from somebody else and they're more senior to you. So if the company goes broke, that more senior debt might actually get their money first before you even get any of your money.
And so typically investment grade debt, which you just said is less risky, is typically more senior?
Yep. Or either more senior or in companies that are a lot more stable and have a lot less debt.
Okay.
So that's...
So it's a combination?
Yeah, it's a combination of the two. And then that investment grade debt, you know, you might be getting sort of 2 or 3% returns on that, whereas you might be able to get 4 or 5% on some of the higher...
More
risky stuff.
Okay, the high yield, yep.
Yeah. And so that's the corporate debt. The next part is the government debt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, depending upon how you're investing in government debt, I tend to take the view that governments do occasionally default, so they do occasionally not pay the money that they've borrowed, but it is almost exclusively they default on foreigners. They don't like to vote on voters, and they want to keep their markets open. So,
have you got an example of the last time a government defaulted on voters on their own currency debt?
I'm not sure. There's certainly possibly Argentina. Actually, I don't think Argentina. I think Argentina defaulted on mainly foreigners.
Okay.
We'll see if
we can find one and put it in the show notes.
Yeah, that's right. But so if you're investing in international other governments' debts, then there is the risk of default. that if you're investing in your own country and your country owns a printing press and can do its own, prints its own currency, which Australia does and the UK does and the US does, then the chance of them actually defaulting is very, very low, because they can effectively just print some more money and give it to people. So they can sort of effectively default by running really high levels of inflation.
You'll still get your money back.
But you're still getting your actual money back. So that's seen as basically the lowest risk asset, which is the buying government bonds.
Okay. And so just to clarify that point on they could effectively default by running high inflation, I think what you mean there is that you'll get your money back, but you won't be able to buy as much with it as if they hadn't run high inflation.
Exactly, yeah. So generally they've got a face value of $100. So you buy it for $100, they'll pay you a 1% or 2% interest rate for the next 10 years, and then at the end of it, they're going to give you $100 back. You'll get that $100 most likely, but maybe in the meantime, $100 used to be able to buy you a night out on the town, and now
buys you half a night.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You got to go home at 12 o'clock instead of 5 a.m.
Yes. That's not half a night for me. Half a night's going home at 9 p.m. rather than... anyway.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, yeah.
So before we move off the government debt, just to clarify, to summarise maybe, you're saying that the safest way to invest in government debt is the government of which you are a voting citizen in the currency of that country of which you're a citizen.
Yeah, so you're not running any currency risk, and your default risk is very, very, very low, almost negligible. Yeah, and so for the large part, what we try and do, so we're only managing the higher quality assets. So in terms of the equities, we only manage the really big stocks, and we screen them very much for quality and value to make sure that we're getting sort of the blue chip ones, the lowest risk versions, and we invest in the government debt. And in the stocks, we'll choose between international and Australian stocks.
Yep.
And so our idea very much in Nucleus is the idea we've got this core portfolio, which is your sort of your safer sleep at night type stuff. So it's high quality shares, it's high quality bonds, it's not stuff that you need to worry about as much as other assets. With the idea that then if investors do want to get some more excitement and have some Argentinian debt to get you some great yields, or at the risk of losing, or if you want to buy small cap stocks or small stocks that might be a lot more volatile, or you want to buy hedge funds or distressed debt, you can do that around that, knowing that you've got that sort of core holding that's there to try and keep the value of your assets relatively safe.
Yep. Okay. So do we want to just briefly talk about this risk and return trade-off that sort of is so central to financial theory? Because we've talked a lot about risk, but why? Like, I mean, if we just talk about by itself, I have the question, why would I take on more risk in investing than just have less?
Yeah, sure. So the idea is if you take on a risk, you should be getting a return for it. And that doesn't exist for every asset, but in general, it does across. If you invest in equities, you end up getting a much higher return in the long term than if you invested in cash or bonds and the short-term bonds or long-term bonds. So if you look over sort of 100 years of data, there's very clear pattern that you sort of get. In cash, you sort of get inflation-ish returns. And then as you start sort of stepping up the bonds, you'll get slightly higher than inflation. And then once you get to equities, you sort of tend to get maybe 4% above inflation as your 4 or 5% above inflation as your target for that.
Mm. Okay. So we want to invest in equities because it can give us a higher return, basically.
Yeah,
but that comes at a cost.
Exactly, if you have the tolerance for it. So the question for us is saying, and then we sort of will run surveys on people as they come in to basically go, well, how much? If you're sort of sitting there going, look, I've got a fixed amount of money, I'm not going to be making any more. This is what I need. This is what needs to last me to retirement, and it's only just going to make it. Mm-hmm. Then we'll be much more likely to put you into quite a low risk and have lots of bonds. You won't get the same upside, but it's protecting your downside.
Mm.
And especially as what we're really trying to do is again that safe core nucleus of your assets.
Yep.
That's where our focus is. And then for people who can tolerate more risk because they've got a longer time frame. So if we're talking to a 30-year-old with the same money as a 70-year-old, we're much more likely to put the 30-year-old into some equities, because if there is a drawdown of 10, 20, 30% in 1 year, you can make that back over the longer term. Whereas for somebody who's closer to who's in retirement and needs that money to survive on, it's much more risky, obviously, to be at the mercy of the market.
Okay. So I think risk tolerance, that's a great one to dive into with Tim maybe in a later episode. There's obviously actually quite a lot underlying that. Time is a really great one, but there's other stuff as well. Yeah. So make sure you do
research. I'm going to preempt your question. So what we've talked about here is the asset allocation. So now what really matters now when you're looking at performance, if you're looking at somebody's performance report, what you really care about is what is their asset allocation? Mm-hmm. Because if you're looking at somebody who's invested only in international stocks, they will tend to be more volatile than somebody who's in Australian stocks. Mm-hmm. Or if you're looking at somebody who's using cash and bonds and equities, so if you look at our different portfolios, say this month our income portfolio was up 1% and our growth portfolio was up 3.7%. Now that's because the income portfolio is positioned for people who are who have got a need for more stability, mm-hmm. and so the actual volatility of that portfolio was very low in terms of it basically just edged its way up over the period. Whereas the growth portfolio was a bit more volatile, certainly nowhere near as volatile as say our international portfolio that was up sort of over 5% for the month. But it's a matter of saying, well, measuring the amount of risk that's necessary, because the portfolio that was up 5 or 6% could easily be down 3 or 4% next month, if markets happen to move in the wrong direction. Whereas the income portfolio is very, very unlikely to fall sort of large amounts in any 1 month.
Okay. Okay. So I noticed you just started using this term volatility. Do you use that? Is it the same thing as risk, or
it's related? Okay. It's closely related. So
because some people do use them interchangeably.
Yeah, that's right. I think that the key thing is the volatility is what we're talking about. How is how much the share price or price of the bond goes up and down in any 1 month or week or year. The issue with the volatility is that you're actually looking at an outcome. So what you're looking at is saying, so when I look at a stock, for example, I think of a stock's volatility as how volatile the earnings or dividends from that stock. And if you've got a stock with particularly volatile earnings or dividends, then that should manifest itself in a volatile share price. But the volatile share price is an outcome. It's not it's not the actual underlying volatility of the stock. That's
or the asset even.
Yes.
Because I guess property is another one that you can look at that typically is seen as not being very volatile at all. And that's actually sometimes more of a function of the fact it doesn't trade that much and it's very unique. One house can't necessarily be compared to another or commercial
Absolutely.
Houses.
Yeah. Okay. So I very much think of price as being and we actually in our models we run those separately. We have a price stability where we look at all the different price stability metrics, mm-hmm. and then we have an earnings stability where we look at all the earnings stability. And both of them are important. We look for places where they don't match up to try and work out which one's right, which one's wrong, and so maybe there's opportunities to buy or sell. But they're definitely two. We would default back to the earnings volatility and the cash flow volatility as being the one which we care most about,
as opposed to the share price.
Okay. Yeah, because so.
But as an investor, if you're not looking at the earnings and cash flow volatility, you're just going to see day to day that price volatility in your portfolio. So
yes.
I guess it is great for you to make us aware that there are those different volatility metrics that can be related, but might not be as well.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So, you definitely preempted my question because I was going to put it at the end. on the slide here, I'm just saying that when you're comparing different investments and the performance of them, you want to be comparing apples with apples. Mm. I mean, these aren't the same apples. That was a joke.
Yes.
Maybe a pun.
So the benchmark's very important. So knowing what's the benchmark is it an appropriate benchmark? So there's two parts to it. One is, for example, in our international portfolios, we benchmark ourselves to a portfolio called the MSCI World Index, and that's a benchmark that has the top 1,600 stocks in the world, which is about top 60 or 70 Aussie stocks, and very similar to that's the universe we're choosing from when we're looking for stocks. So,
okay. So
for us, that sort of fits. If we chose a different benchmark, say like a small cap version, then that probably wouldn't be appropriate because we're not actually buying small cap global stocks. Or if we chose the ASX and said, okay, we're going to benchmark ourselves to the ASX for that international, that's not really appropriate because it's a different universe.
Yeah, and they have very different characteristics.
Exactly.
We're about to move on. But before we move on to the characteristics, benchmarks. So this is really important. And I think that before I did my commerce degree, I was sort of scratching my head about what does the S&P 500, the ASX 200, what do they all mean? I guess my really simplified way of explaining it would be, and this isn't exactly right, it's approximately right. It's basically a summation of the share prices of the stocks in that index. Do you have a better way, or maybe more accurate way of describing it?
No, the really accurate way is you take the share price and how many shares are out there and multiply them together, and that gets you the total size of the company. Then you actually cut out any corporate shareholders, and then that's how big it is as part of it. So for example, if you're looking at Amazon, for example, you'd add up the total value of the share price, total number of shares out there. Then you take away Jeff Bezos' shares because you say, well,
okay.
He's actually a corporate shareholder and he's not actually out trading that.
Yeah, you can't actually access that.
Yeah, so you cut out all his shares and maybe a few of the other insiders, and then that's the size of the Amazon as part of the S&P 500 index, say.
Okay. So if the ASX 200 goes up today, that means the value of all of those stocks underneath it has gone up.
Yeah.
Or if it goes down, the total summed value has gone down across everything.
Yes. And that can hide some, and especially over the last year, that's hidden some of the things that are actually going on within the market. Yeah. So last year was all very much growth stocks. And that's what we spend a lot of talking about is this month's reviews. Just that, growth stocks had a really good run last year, but come November, the story very much changed, and then it was all about value and cyclical stocks, which have been performing really well. So despite the market itself being up, it's different components of the market that have been performing well, and that's where trying to work out how much of your portfolio to allocate to those different ones has really been what's been important.
Okay, perfect. So, Jaden, can we go back to slide 3, please? That's where, for me, that's where this spiky 3D object comes in terms of looking at in all of these different ways. So, under security selection, the first 7 are yours that you use to analyze the exposures within the portfolio and understand across all of it, what are you actually exposed to, which risks? Mm. And then the 8th one, style exposure, is what you were just explaining to us about growth and value. So do you want to quickly define growth and value?
Yeah, so this comes from MSCI definitions of how they look at, and the MSCI provides some of these indexes and just does calculations about how to divide stocks and what. So they've got basically 3 different options. You can be a value stock, which tends to mean you're cheap. You can be a quality stock, which tends to mean you're making good returns on your on the assets that you have, and you're earning quite high margins.
Okay, so a good return is if you have a factory somewhere, a plant, something, building something, and you're making, 6% on it, or
exactly.
10% is probably good. Is
So somebody's invested $100 in it, and in one company they're earning back $10 a year, and another company they're earning back $2 a year.
Yeah, perfect.
And
okay, so
the company that's earning back for the $100 investment, you're earning back $10 a year is the good. Yeah. And so, what they tend to say is, growth is basically anything left over.
Unintuitive.
Yeah, and the way they put together, there's lots of issues with the way they put it together. But the idea is that if you're buying a company, you're either getting it for cheap or you're paying more money because you're getting a quality company. Mm-hmm. If your company is neither cheap nor good quality, then you must be buying it because you think it's going to grow. Is basically the logic they're using to get there.
Okay, right. Okay.
But you would think that from someone
standing
back.
Start with growth as opposed to growth being the
For someone standing back, you'd go, oh, well, this must be a company that is growing. But growth is such a – it's a very nebulous concept and how to get to it. And so that's how they're sort of – that's the remainder effectively. We tend to look at things a bit differently, but, you know, I think if you're seeing growth versus value elsewhere, that's – well, generally that's what people are
I feel like considering. When I'm reading press about – style, so value or growth stocks. I never read much about quality.
No, you don't see as much about it. Quality's had a very good run from 2016 to 2020-ish. Uh-huh. So it does quite well in sort of low growth environments and sort of disinflation. And that's where the quality stocks really come to the fore. The ones that can keep getting those good returns. And so. So we run a mix between quality and value because we think both of them have their days in the sun, and they're both different bets as well. Like a quality, when you're taking a bet on quality, you're basically saying I'm buying a company because I think that's high quality because I think it's going to keep being high quality. Mm-hmm. So you're making a bet on no mean reversion. Whereas when you're saying I'm buying this and that's where it's going to be. And then for a value stock, you're actually buying a stock and saying, okay, it's cheap right now, but I don't think it's going to be cheap in the future. And so you are betting it's going to go back to average.
Okay.
And so there's actually quite a neat disconnect between those that actually mean if you're sort of combining them together in a portfolio, it actually gives you some extra, it actually reduces the volatility of your portfolio.
And this asymmetrical upside skew?
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay.
So that's the idea. And it gives us that scope to say, times like the last month, where most of our performance came from our value stocks.
Okay.
And so we bought a number of stocks in there, things like cement makers, which are not high quality stocks. You know, they don't earn massive margins. They do get volatile over the cycles, mm-hmm. but they're generally pretty cheap. And you pick them at the right point of the cycle. And just, you know, as you're getting big stimulus globally, you know, they can perform quite well.
Okay.
And so, whereas at the start of last year, or certainly during the virus, we were very much focused on the quality end, about saying if we're buying the quality stocks, they're the ones that are going to hold up better in terms of the downturn, the ones that have the bigger margins, so that when sales drops, they're still actually making a profit versus the other ones, which when sales drop, they actually end up being loss making, and you worry about whether the company will last.
Yeah. Okay. So. I'm conscious of time. That's why I'm hesitating. But I do actually want to go through those others under security selection. Do you want to start with the sector, industry, and work your way down?
Yeah. So for my part, and none of these ones are that easy to find. These tend to need analytics to go through. We actually do need to go through stock by stock and look at what they do and where they're earning the money. Because for me, it's very important to get back to actually why you own a stock. And so the business model is one where we look at saying, okay, does this company make its money from, say, owning a factory which then produces widgets, and that's where they make the money from? Or is it because they've actually created some intellectual property, mm-hmm. and all they're really doing is licensing that to other people, and so they're actually not making anything themselves. They own the intellectual property, yes. and they're just licensing it out.
Worth, before you keep going, to introduce this idea of competitive advantage? Or is this maybe not necessary in the context of this?
Maybe on one of the later ones. Okay, sure. So let me talk about, a healthcare stock, because this is probably where some of these really come into it.
Okay.
So you can have a biotechnology stock, or a healthcare stock that owns a patent to a... they created the drug, say it's a vaccine, mm-hmm. and so, but they've licensed it to somebody else to actually produce it. So, and they just get paid this royalty fee. So that's one way of making money.
Is this what we're seeing at the moment with the COVID vaccines?
Yes.
Okay, so there are some that have just found the formula and they've licensed that to someone else.
Yeah, it's Pfizer and BioNTech. I think so. BioNTech's the one that found it.
Oh, I see.
And they're licensing
it. Okay.
And so then you go... And then you've got somebody manufacturing it, which has got makes a margin on that.
Okay.
And then you've got the distribution of it. So some places have these big distribution networks into hospitals and pharmacies and doctors.
So it's like a sales force that have to go out and explain to everyone.
Exactly. And so for those ones, and so knowing where your value lies. So if I've got somebody who's only got these royalties, I need to be really careful about knowing when they're going to run out.
Okay.
If I'm looking at a company that has these big sales forces that actually push into it, then I don't care as much, because they're just going to buy the next, they can go out and buy the smaller companies. It's like your Pfizer's who can go out and buy these smaller companies, and they can push them through either their own manufacturing or they can push them through their own distribution network. And so when I buy a company, I want to know what I'm getting, because if I look at someone who's only owns the royalty side of it, they should be earning massive margins. They've already spent the money on R&D. Now they're just collecting the they're collecting their royalty check. Like, so they shouldn't really have a big cost.
So margin is basically revenue minus costs, right? That's kind of your profit.
Yep.
And the reason you're saying that they should be earning massive margins because they've already spent the money is that they've costed that out in a previous period.
Yep.
So now what are their costs? The next project, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. They're just collecting their check. And then so knowing where you're getting that from, because if you own a manufacturing part, then you need to have invested in invested a lot of money in that, and so you'll have these depreciation charges of your equipment and everything like that. That's sort of depreciating.
Does R&D depreciate?
You can either write it off or depreciate. Yeah,
company, sure.
But the idea is that I need to be looking at those companies differently, because they I can handle a lower margin on those ones, and I can look at what the capex costs and things like that are. Whereas if they've actually outsourced all their manufacturing to somebody else, then they should be earning higher margins. And so it's not just about saying, are you high margin or low margin? It's about saying, are you high margin or low margin for what you're actually doing?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Mm. So it's relative.
Everything's relative, yeah, because otherwise you turn around and you start looking and you say, I just want to have companies that are earning high margins. Oh, just a minute. I've got all these companies that are just own royalties or just doing services or something like that.
Mm.
And I've missed this whole basket of companies that are actually earning lower margins, but they're earning lower margins because that's the nature of their business. Mm. It's an accounting sort of – but they might be earning high margins relative to other people in their industry.
Yeah, so they're doing it better, maybe you could say.
Yeah.
Okay. So the problem with just focusing, for example, as you said, on high margins is that can – again, as you said – you can be in just one sort of area, invest in one area, and that there's risks attached with just invested in this one area.
And you might have thought that you might think you're diversified because you've got, I've got some energy, I've got some stocks that are in the energy sector, and I've got some stocks that are in the property sector, and I've got some stocks that are in the manufacturing sector and all that. But if you've done this screen to pull out things on high margins, you've got a services person in the property sector, but you don't have you don't have a developer or whatever. You don't own any of the properties.
Yeah.
You've got an energy player who actually is just a service provider to the energy things. It doesn't actually own any of the assets. You've got somebody in the industrial thing that's outsourced all the things and they're just providing services.
Yeah.
So it's making sure that you're not ending up owning
just services companies.
Yeah.
Which to services companies.
And the thing is, we might want to do that, but we want to make sure it's a conscious decision.
Yeah.
It's not that you're just running a model that happens to put you into one of a certain type, that just loves a certain type of company, and so that's all you ever buy.
This is really what this whole thing is about, right? You look at it from all the different angles to understand all the risks you're taking on and to know all the risks you're taking
exactly,
on.
Exactly, yeah.
So you can manage them. You don't want to be unaware.
Yes, that's right. And so, a good example of where Australians often go wrong is they go, okay, I've got this diversified portfolio where, I own some property, I own some hybrids, I own some banking shares, you go through these and I've got some realestate.com and you go through these bits and you're like, you've got six different flavours of Australian real estate exposure.
Yeah.
And so, yes, they're all in different sectors and they're all, and they've all got
different
drivers,
types or classes.
But if that one sector falls over, you've lost money on every single one of these. Yeah. And that's where you don't want to be, you don't want to be in those types of scenarios. So it's about trying to work out. Yeah.
Okay. And diversification, I am conscious that we haven't defined that yet on this program. So would you do us the honors?
Yeah, basically the best example is you're selling sunscreen and you're also selling umbrellas. So you're at the beach and you know that, okay, if it's a sunny day, I'm out selling sunscreen, and if it's a rainy day, I'm out selling umbrellas. Over the course of a year, I'm going to sell both of them, but it's not like I'm making all my money in one week and none of it in the other. So
you've got exposure to different possible outcomes.
Exactly.
Within investing, there are so many different possible outcomes that diversification is often more than just two products.
Yeah, exactly. And you want to have things where you're saying they're all going up, but they're not all going up together and all going down together.
Okay.
So that example I was using of the person who's invested in all these different things on property. You're saying, well, if the Australian property market goes well, great, you're going to make truckloads of money because you've basically taken one bet. And if it goes badly, then you're going to do badly. Whereas if you can say, well, I've taken a bet on Australian property and a bit on Australian mining and a bit on Australian industrial, and you know, you've taken a whole bunch of different bets, you know, maybe one will go up this year and down next year, and the other one will go sideways this year and up next year. And you know, it's just that your whole portfolio is not moving all in one direction at once and all in
other way,
once. The other way.
Okay. Mm. Excellent. So what have we got left up here?
Customer types. So we look at, are you selling to governments? Are you selling to other businesses? Are you selling to directly to consumers? So sort of making sure you've got a bit of a mix of that. You don't want to be all, all in terms of selling only to governments or only to consumers and running into your problems when you go into lockdowns and all of a sudden consumers aren't spending. Is that if you've focused all your money on that area, then you'll suffer more than if you've got a spread of governments and businesses.
Yeah, because I guess we went into lockdown and consumers started tightening their belts and weren't spending as much. But yeah. Governments were, they had all of these programs that they had to do as a result
out.
Of it.
Yeah. And also consumers, you know, that came back to our services versus manufacturing. People started buying a lot more goods, but they weren't buying as many services because, everyone else was locked down and you couldn't have the services.
Yeah.
And so,
or at least here in Australia.
Yeah. Well, and elsewhere as well. But, so travel, for example, is a service and you couldn't have the travel services. Or you wanted to have a haircut or get a massage or whatever it is. And there's a lot of lockdowns and a lot of preventions of those. So, so you wanted to make sure, whereas the manufacturing actually, people were buying a lot of goods online. And so, the manufacturing actually came up better than the services. Customer purchase frequencies, a lot about whether, are you selling, say, cans of Coke where every day you need to go and sell another one? Or are you selling a Netflix subscription where you've locked in from month to month? Or are you selling a software contract to a company that's got a 5-year time period? And so you know you're locked away, or you've got you're a real estate with a 5-year lease or 10-year lease. So it's knowing about what types of transactional businesses are you in. And again, this is not saying one of them's right or one of them's wrong, but it's making sure that you're not running this model that just overly biases towards buying a particular type without knowing without knowing that you're actually taking that risk. Okay. Customer feature, the target market. So there's a depending where companies are listed is not always where they're actually making their money from.
Yep.
And especially once you're looking at large capitalization stocks, which is what we spend most of our time doing.
Yep.
So, one of the places that we've made some good money last month from was cement manufacturers, but they were very expensive in the US, but you could buy a couple of there was a couple of European ones that we bought that have big exposures into the US, but they happen to be listed in Europe. So we could pick them up 20-30% cheaper than buying the equivalent US stock, and then get the good
same
return.
Same exposure.
Yeah, same exposure to
similar
exposure, exactly. That sort of comes back to currency exposure as well. So yeah, so it's not just it is actually knowing. So in terms of currency exposure, we look very much at the difference between where somebody's doing something, where they're making their revenues and where they're making their costs. So what I'm concerned about is a currency mismatch. So resource companies are probably one of the key ones here, where if you've got a mine in Australia, then your costs are largely Australian dollar. You probably have some US dollar fuel costs, but your revenues are US dollar based. So the copper or the iron ore is priced in US dollars. And so you're getting revenue in one line and you've got costs in another. And so if they move in the wrong direction, you can lose out. And if they move in the right direction, you can double up. So knowing that's the case, there's other ones where there's some manufacturers, say a Cochlear or a CSL is actually knowing, okay, how much manufacturing do they have in Australia and then where are they selling it to? And so looking at those same types of factors. Or are they companies that actually manufacture in a whole bunch of different countries? And so they'd say, so they might have operations in six different countries and they generally just service their local market.
Yeah.
or if you're a McDonald's, for example, most of your costs are in local currency and you just translate it back. And so knowing which currencies are you exposed to when you really look through to it, and that example of saying, okay, I've bought a stock that's in Switzerland, for example, but it's a cement maker that's actually global operations and its biggest operations are actually in the US.
Yeah.
And so knowing that that's my real exposure, I haven't got a massive exposure to Switzerland. I've got a company that happens to be listed in Switzerland that's got exposure right throughout.
But by virtue of owning a stock on the Swiss exchange, you have Swiss franc exposure as well?
Yeah, to a certain extent. But what tends to happen in large stocks in particular is that they're bought by global investors who will then recognise that things are going well in the US and the price will... So if you're in that stock and say the Swiss franc's
Because they have to convert it back to franc.
And they're looking at a local Swiss company and saying, okay, here's this Swiss company that's earnings are flat and here's this Swiss company that's only got Swiss customers and their earnings are flat over the year. And then here's another company that's listed in Switzerland but it's got all these US operations and their earnings are up 10% over the year. Okay, that share price is going to go up a lot more on a relative basis.
Okay, I think that rounds out security selection.
Yeah.
So I think... I wanted to talk about the economic sort of thematic side of it too, at least briefly, because you need to consider how those flow through the portfolios. And I think that the model that you've explained for security selection explains to some degree how those you'll think about them and flow through it. Mm. But, you sort of sum up your whole portfolio and then you look at currency exposure. Political exposure is a big one that they talk about on an economic sort of level.
Yeah, sure. So, and we also look at the individual ratios that get out. So, you say, okay, we think we're buying a portfolio. That's got lots of value characteristics. Is it cheaper than the market once we add it all up? So we've got all these stocks together, we add them all up.
Yeah.
And then on a cash flow basis, on a price basis, on a book value basis, how does it actually stack up versus the market? And so one of the things we were doing, which worked quite well for us last month, was over the last few months, which worked quite well for us for maybe 3 or 4 months, is we've been looking for more what's called value exposure. So we spoke about what a value stock is.
Yeah.
They tend to be stocks that are cheaper, and when the economy picks up, they tend to perform better. And so they're the types of stocks we were looking for. And as we looked through our portfolio, there was times where we were like, look, you know what, we're actually pretty happy with all the companies we have, but we've diversified and all these things. But then when we add up the characteristics, we're like, oh, actually, our portfolio hasn't got a lot of value in it. It's actually got more average value stocks than it does have good value stocks.
Okay.
And we had more high quality stocks than that was the other side of the thing, was we ended up with more high quality stocks and not enough sort of value stocks. And that was the impetus to say, well, even though there's stocks in there we quite like and we were sort of happy with the diversification, is we want to make sure we're going to, if the economy is going into this uplift phase, is that we've got more value. And that's where we went out and bought bought some more travel stocks, bought some more cement stocks, bought some more there's stocks that are exposed to employment services and things like that, where the whole idea was for us is that and for some part, it wasn't by buying new stocks. It was basically saying, okay, well, there's a stock. Let's go and buy twice as much of that stock and halve our exposure in this other one. And at some stage, we'll flip back and do it the other way around. But it's about saying, as I'm putting together a portfolio, if you just start adding stocks you like, way a typical person does at home, you start adding stocks you like and you sort of look at it and you go, well, I sort of like all the stocks, but should I sell half of that and buy more of this one? I don't know.
Mm.
Like there's no real reason for it. But if you're looking at all these different factors and saying, well, what am I looking for over the next period, and identifying to say, well, I think there is this cyclical upswing, we do want more value.
Yep.
Okay, now we need to make some changes within our portfolio because of that. Mm.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. So that was a lot, but I think worthwhile. We can skip on now to the next slide and let's use this framework that we've just created to talk through the performance for the Core International portfolio in March.
Yeah. So I mean, what we're looking at here is... and it's just some shots from some of the reports which we run to look at where we're getting the performance from, and so we can see that I spoke about the cement being the well, and the construction materials as being that key one at the top there. We looked through some of the individual stocks and in the table below to see which ones are performing and not performing. Now, I try not to be too influenced by stock movements. Like a lot of it comes back to if we own a stock and the stock's just gone up 20% in a month, but the earnings have gone up 40 or 50%, then it's cheaper than what it was at the start of the month, despite the rise in the price. And so I actually try very hard to forget where we bought stocks at so that you don't get caught in that whole part about, oh, I bought this stock for $20 and it fell down to 18 and now it's back up to 20. I better sell it to get my money back or it's only at 19 and now I don't want to sell it because I want to get one more dollar out of it. Try and take that step back to say, no, I actually just want to know today how does it sit on a relative basis versus other stocks and how does it sit within that. So, you can look at these just trying to say which parts of the portfolio are performing well and which ones aren't. Mm-hmm. In the parts that are performing well, have they overshot the targets?
Okay.
So construction materials is certainly one area where, if those things double and triple, we're certainly not going to hold them. They're not. We bought them because they're value stocks. They're not hugely high quality. They'll get a bit of growth over the next few years.
But not a lot.
But, yeah. It's time to get out. Whereas there's other stocks that will sit in our portfolio, your Apples or Microsofts, where very, very high quality stocks earning great returns. And they'll get a little bit expensive, they'll get a little bit cheap. We tend not to try and trade them too much. We buy the high quality ones and like to hold the high quality ones.
Okay.
And only sell them when they get really expensive. Whereas if we're buying stocks for value purposes, we're more likely to trade those if they go up.
So why is that?
So a stock that we bought because it's good value now, we're buying it because we think it's going to revert back to the mean and become more expensive.
Yep.
And so when it does, it's time to sell it and go look for another one. For a high-quality stock, we're buying that high-quality stock because we think it's going to keep being high-quality and keep churning out those returns for a long, long time.
Okay.
And so we put it in the portfolio and we try and hold it as long as we can.
So if you identify a stock as being value, that you're essentially saying that you think it's going to trade within a range.
Yep.
Whereas if it's quality, the thought process, and this comes back to what you said before about quality not being mean reverting, is it's more likely to trend up.
Yes.
So if you were to sell it, to support that trend up. So if you were to sell it, then you wouldn't expect to get that same buying opportunity lower down that you would on a value stock.
Yeah, exactly. And the value stocks tend to be cyclical, and they're often called cyclicals.
Mm-hmm.
I'll fully expect, say, the cement manufacturers to run up over the next year or two still, and then as the earnings comes through and people start looking at the other side of it, they'll start falling, and more competitors start coming on to chase the revenue gains, they'll then start falling away. And so, fully expect that to go through a cycle, and just over the next 10, 20 years, they'll be up for a few years, they'll be down for a few years, they'll be up for a few years, down. And whereas when you buy a high-quality stock, you're buying it with the expectation that they're actually generating really good returns on their money,
mm-hmm.
and they're just going to keep growing that. You know, there might be small ups and downs, but the general trend will be up.
Okay. Mm. So what's a high-quality stock in Australia at the moment, or has been for the past decade?
CSL. Yeah. It's a very high-quality stock, but it's so expensive. So we've got a little bit of it, but it's just a question of trying to get it at the right price. So that's a good example of one we owned, and the stock price just kept running up, and we eventually got to the stage where we own a little bit of it now, but we're very underweight compared to the market.
Right.
And so whereas a BHP or any of the mining stocks, I think of as value stocks, they're not particularly – they're high-quality relative to other miners,
mm-hmm.
but the mining sector is very, very cyclical. Mm. It will go through massive highs and massive lows, and
so that's where it comes back to what we discussed before about all of the different factors that you have to consider when you're looking at the stock. What sector is it exposed to? What is it actually doing in its business model? Who's it selling to? So on and so forth.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Is there anything else that you think you want to highlight from the international performance this month?
No, some of the other stats we look at, which I haven't shown on screen here, but we do look at a range of other measures that look at the volatility of the portfolio and how it's reacting with the market. So it's something called the beta which is basically if the market goes up by 1%, does our portfolio go up by 1% or does it tend to go up by less? And same on the downside. And so we look at the upside and downside and just make sure that we're trying to create portfolios that can sort of hang with the market on the way up and give you protection on the way down is the rough, yep. rough guide. And even if we underperform a little bit, you know, if we underperform by 0.5% or 1% on the way up, but on the way down we can save 2 or 3%,
yep.
then the net, the round trip is you're in front.
So that sounds like that asymmetry again.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so I look at a lot of reports that trying to focus in and saying, is that happening? So that's what we're trying to do. Are we being successful? And if we're not being successful, we need to be, you know, okay, which are the stocks that are doing it? Is that a genuine issue or is it a short-term issue? Is it a one-off? You know, every now and again, you'll just an individual stock might run up or fall away, and you just need to you know, be aware of what that is. And it's very important as well if you're trying to run your own portfolios, is that trying to be just as critical in the period where you did really well as what you did. You know, it's very easy to say, oh, had a bad month last month. I'm going to really look through my portfolio and try and work out what's going wrong and fix it. But you need to really look at it's just as important to look at your good months and say, okay, I've had a really good month last month. Was I just lucky? Did I just have a stock that was taken over or something like that? Was there actual, you know, was there something in there that was actually, that really drove that performance? And without that, I wouldn't have actually done as well. And so now I do need to dig in and try and work out what's wrong with the portfolio as well. And the other part, you know, you can obviously see some lines going up and some lines going down in those. There are stocks we own with a view that we might not be right, and so here's a stock which, if we are right, it's going to underperform. So we got it right, and we made money on you know, these 30 stocks we owned, and here's 10 stocks we actually lost money on, and we're happy that we lost money on it. Well, not, you know, not happy, but we understand we lost money on it. That was their role. Their role was an insurance in there in case we were wrong on the other ones.
Okay,
and so. We're not beating ourselves up for owning those
stocks. You're expected to. I guess that's the thing about finance or markets and valuing things is it's all about expectations. And you hear them talking about this all the time when the economic data comes out. It's better than expected or it's worse than expected, and that's what really drives it. So it sounds like it's the same in your portfolio construction. You're trying to determine what the future state is going to be and construct a portfolio from that. And there's obviously a lot of different possible future states.
Yes.
And if you get a few of them right, or if you guess a few of them and then you do a portfolio for those, and then you find that you are right on them and your portfolio does what you expected it to, then it's like a tick, yes, I'm happy with that. But then if you get the states right, but your portfolio doesn't react how you expected it to, then it's a cross and it's kind of like, okay, I have to learn from this.
Yeah, yep. But it's also, and I think the other main part from that, though, is you need to be just as aware that sometimes you get lucky. And so, treat the times when you've done well just as critically as you treat the times when you've done badly, because it's very easy to look at a portfolio that's done well and say, oh, yeah, I must be a genius. And then, oh, no, it went down. Okay, I must be unlucky. Whereas actually, let's consider the opposite, that actually you were, when it went down is, no, you actually did make a bad decision. But also when it went up, maybe you just did get lucky.
Okay.
And you're bailed out by some sectors. And so you do need to change the portfolio structure.
So a lot of discipline required in this then.
Yep. Absolutely.
So let's move on to the Australian one then. Thanks, Jaden.
Yeah, and Australia is so a similar performance. Australia is dominated by BHP on the downside. So that's one where we're underweight BHP. So even though it was our worst performer, we sort of holding less of BHP than the market. So it's part of the reason for actually outperforming during it. So there's times like that where we're saying, okay, well, we held some of it in case we got it wrong, but we sort of figured iron ore had peaked, and so being underweight that iron ore sector was a plan, but we didn't want to have no iron ore, because there are scenarios, and we've seen it over the last week or two, where the iron ore price has come back.
You guys had a big discussion about this recently on the Investment Insights podcast and the commodity super cycle.
Yeah.
And you definitely sounded to me like there was a possibility that it could keep going. You definitely acknowledged that as a possible outcome.
Yes, exactly. And so And the Australian market is just incredibly concentrated in the resources and the banking mm-hmm. sector. And so
by that, you mean that there is a large portion of the ASX 200 mm-hmm. is made up of those.
So you add those two together and it varies, but yeah, around 40%-ish you can get
to. That's huge.
So whereas globally it's sort of 15-ish maybe.
Okay.
So you sort of got three times as much roughly of those sectors. So really getting that in Australia, getting that call right is pretty much the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
Banks, resources or other. Uh-huh. And actually in terms of other, we'll usually split into international other and non-international other. So yeah. what are the stocks that are actually exposed to offshore? Whereas internationally, you've just got such a broad mosaic of different companies all doing different things and all these different sectors, it's a lot easier to get sort of the diversification and measure yourself as a broadly diversified portfolio, whereas in Australia there's a couple of big calls which you'll either get right or wrong, you know, which will really drive performance in Australia.
All right. Well, that's been a fantastic discussion and I'm really excited to have got into some of the depths of how you put a portfolio together when you're investing, as well as helping people understand those things so that when they're reading your performance reports, they can take a bit more out of it, hopefully. So thank you for that, Damien.
Thank you.
To wrap up the show, if you'd like to hear more from Nucleus Wealth, check out our other podcast, Nucleus Investment Insights, or head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date on news from Nucleus Wealth, you can follow us on social media or subscribe to our newsletter from our homepage. And I'd like to thank my producer, Jaden Stent, for his work on the podcast today. Thank you, Jaden. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. Thanks again for tuning in from myself and the team. We look forward to catching you on the next one. Cheers.